Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming. My name is Laurent Lapierre, and let me welcome you to this fourth of the theme track sessions. Today's session, just like all of the of this year's theme track sessions, focuses on making connections. And the connection that we're making in this particular session is the one between deductive and inductive research, with the purpose of advancing the science and practice of our field. Traditionally speaking, in IO, we've had this rather dramatic emphasis on the deductive research approach. Now, it's kind of comical, because anybody here who is an academic or who is involved in a significant amount of research and data collection, I would be surprised if it wasn't the great majority of you who actually do a version of inductive research when you're looking through your data set, especially when your initial hypotheses do not pan out. What else is there that's significant here? And can I fit a good story to it? So rather, that's not exactly the kind of inductive research that we're going to be promoting here, but it is in the vein of inductive research. What's interesting is that in more recent years, there's been significantly more appreciation for inductive research, especially the qualitative forms of inquiry. But that being said, there's still a great amount of work to be done to systematically integrate both paradigms, both approaches to research. The goal of this session is to help you appreciate, firstly, what really is meant by inductive research, but more importantly, to appreciate and understand how we can formally integrate both approaches, as opposed to focusing on one or the other, and having, if you will, two camps in our field. By integrating both, we are convinced that that is a very promising path to truly achieving breakthroughs in our research and in our practice. So we are fortunate this morning to have three speakers, all SciOp fellows, who are experts in research methodology. Our first speaker, Fred Oswald, is a professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at Rice University. His research focuses on substantive as well as statistical issues concerning the reliability and validity of tests administered to applicants in organizational, educational, and military settings. He is associate editor of the Journal of Management, of Psychological Methods, and of Research Synthesis Methods, and currently is the Research and Science Officer of SciOp. Fred's talk will introduce us to the distinctions between deductive and inductive research, and to the idea that these two approaches to scientific discovery should not be pitted one against the other. Please join me in welcoming Fred.
Great. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for being here, and thanks for overcoming the lure of the beach. This isn't just my PSYOP. This new Frisbee I picked up says so, but it's also your PSYOP, so I thought I would give it away, toss it to the crowd, see if Mindy and Julie, no, it missed them. I aimed for them and missed them, but maybe you can pick one up later or do some wrestling there to get that Frisbee. So thank you for having me. I guess I'll start out by saying, you know, there are compliments to everything. And of course, our friends, bread and butter, salt and pepper, and let's not forget Ernie and Bert. I mean, they're always together. How about inductive and deductive reasoning? You know, perhaps those are compliments as well, as Lowe suggested in the intro. And in fact, we're doing that anyway, right? We are probably doing that anyway in our research, but we can be more mindful about that, and that can serve to profit our research and our practice to understand what are we doing, where are we drawing from pools of deduction in terms of theory and pools of induction in terms of exploration. So let me talk about that in the few minutes I have here. I guess I wanted to provide some words, some nodes that get associated when you bring up the word deductive. And so with deductive comes the idea of theory driven, starting out from an a priori basis, right? Sometimes deductive is extensions where you have existing basis of theory, but then there are logical, at least logical to you, extensions that follow prior to data collection. Similarly, there might be implications. I guess the distinction I'm making here is that some extensions are, are conceptual extensions of existing theory, whereas implications might be empirical, at least the way I was thinking about it here, that, hey, this finding was established, now what's next in terms of building our theory? And when you do that, that's a deductive kind of notion. And I guess a priori thinking in general gets us in the deductive domain, where perhaps there isn't really established theory, but we are smart and well-trained people, and we may generate new things on the deductive side. So that's one part of the complement. And then on the inductive side, words that nodes that come up when you think of inductive are exploration from data. It can also in some ways be exploration from other people's data, just in terms of what they have discovered, right? It doesn't have to be your own local analysis enterprise. It can be other people's results and reaching discovery that way. It can be surprises, right? Sometimes the most interesting innovations are surprises. Of course, we want them to be replicable surprises. We want them to be generalizable surprises, but surprises nonetheless, where we build upon established theory with new findings that lead to new ways of looking at things that are important, generalizable, practical, applicable, and so on. So these are inferences from results that are not predicted by theory or a priori thinking necessarily. As Lo suggested, you know, these aren't camps, but really complementary aspects, like the yin and the yang that I showed here. And we need to think about the inductive and deductive loop. When is one deductive, might you say? Well, you know, if you invented the theory for your own work and it was really truly a priori and not post hoc, then perhaps you were deductive, right? You maybe have borrowed, melded from prior theory and so on, but it's yours in a sense. You put your own filter on it, you developed your own intellectual background, and of course, well justified, this is not post hoc land, this is a priori land where you're developing something new conceptually. That's more of a deductive approach. If you're nerdy and read a lot, I think you're in deductive land where I guess it's tied to the previous point, but I guess the point here is that perhaps you read so widely that there's not just one theory you identify necessarily as necessary for your work. There's actually a palette, a complement of theories that you're bringing together in your own unique production, that is your own work. So you know a lot of theories, you know how to integrate them into some super theory, or super to you anyway. Another way you might be deductive is when reviewer two, the famous or infamous reviewer two, reminds you of the theory that you lack and accounts for your results, and I guess in an extreme sense it wouldn't be deductive. It could be harking by somebody else. But in another sense, it could be that truly your findings were deductive, but by somebody else that saw the logical link that that really did precede your data. Perhaps they thought about it before that you ever presented the results in the paper that reviewer two was looking at. And here, reviewer two is so good, they get their own certificate. If only we could be that good of a reviewer, right? So when are we inductive? Well, when we're inductive, we're data-driven. However, these red points in red here are to qualify the inductive notions here, that there are some deductive complements to this, that we're data-driven, yet the data are often driven by data and theory. So we're not analyzing random sets of variables. There was some sort of, if not theory, some sort of thinking that led to the assemblage and measurement of these variables that you're dealing with. Induction can be exploration. You know, again, given the variables and the analyses that are specified, analyses aren't random either. They're quite planned, right? And they guide the exploration. So a guided exploration is the notion of an inductive and deductive complement. Discovery often connects back to theory, right? For example, when you find moderators. So it's not a discovery in a vacuum. It's a discovery as it's tied to what we know already. And so induction here in the form of discovery or surprises gets tied to our existing knowledge base. We don't just examine the surprise in isolation and deal with it there. We tie it into our knowledge and then extend it. And we're inductive when, in fact, there is a lack of knowledge. I suppose there could be real wildernesses in terms of investigating data, and I'm sure many of the big data sessions I was unable to attend explored some of those possibilities where you can go through the wide range of data and perhaps find reliable associations that are in fact interpretable and generalizable, or at least that's the goal for these analyses often. So outside of our profession, outside of our field, there have been cases of basically induction, but some drive in terms of deduction. So in terms of deduction, there were some initial theories regarding penicillin as an antibiotic, but what spurred the growth of penicillin was the laboratory accident of Joseph Fleming, where mold inhibited the growth of staph. The idea there, the connections were made that, hey, perhaps there were antibiotic properties that were suspected, and that in turn led to mass production of what could be said as a miracle, medical miracle in 1945. Likewise, Paul Dirac creates a general system of formulas for quantum mechanics, and this is more deductive. The idea that, hey, here's some formulas of quantum mechanics. There are predictions that can be made from these formulas that have not been observed in data yet, namely that of antimatter. That basically, there were negative values that resulted from these equations that led to the suggestion of antimatter, the complement of matter. And sure enough, antimatter was discovered. And the Higgs boson, which was predicted in the 60s, was actually discovered in 2012. So Jeff Edwards will have organizational examples of the inductive and deductive relationships here, but I thought I would suggest that we are not alone in these discoveries that come either from one way or the other. So why should these distinctions lead to camps? Why are there camps? Are there camps? I suppose there are many types of camps. There are many ways we can think of in-groups and out-groups, and I think for induction, deduction, we could slice the pie in different ways where we're not talking to each other. But here's some ideas. One is that, if you're purely inductive, that leads to a new deductive future for us. So I guess the point here is that, even if you feel like you're in a camp of induction, it's important to see the big picture, that you might be thinking more in discovery mode, but realize that this is potentially leading to more theoretical work that may become really a foundation, almost become accepted in terms of theory in the future. And if you're mindful about that as an explorer yourself, then you might feel less encamped in terms of an induction mindset. I guess I'll hop to the last point to say that our old habits, the idea of camps, can be broken. And the camps I was thinking of here was more the methods camps, where there are qualitative and quantitative camps. And qualitative can seem more like induction, observing, recording, and then generating systematic streams of thought and of research that is more quantitative in nature. And those camps can be divided. They can seem pretty distinct, but of course they don't need to be. And when you think about mixed methods, right, that's all about an integration of the two. So perhaps we could have camp induction, right, where they're all working together and happy and complimenting one another, and so on. And let me close just by saying that this PSYOP theme was all about connections, and the connections between induction and deduction can happen and should happen, let's say, in our graduate training, right, from the ground up, that more integrated work can happen there. And then, talks like this, I think, will end up being quite different. So thanks a lot.
Thank you, Fred. Our second speaker today is Ron Landis. He is the Nambari S. Raju Professor of Psychology and Chair of the Psych Department at Illinois Institute of Technology. His primary research interests are in the areas of structural equation modeling, multiple regression, and other issues associated with measurement and the prediction of performance. He's a principal investigator for a three-year NSF-funded study worth $1.3 million. Examining the roles of emotion, cognition, and metacognition in learning science. He is also currently serving as the associate editor for the Journal of Business and Psychology. So join me in welcoming Ron.
Thank you. So I have to confess, I made a mistake. You know, the title is Big Data. I wanted to talk about sort of induction through the lens of big data. Fred just told me that's not big. I thought big data was elephants and things, but. So bear with me. Actually, when I was approached about this idea, there were two things that sort of jumped to mind. One is this sort of, I don't know if it's a proverb, story, I don't know what the right word to call it is, but this is, and I'll talk about this in just a second. And the other is sort of this idea of our sort of being enamored with big data. And I think the idea of inductive research and big data seemed like some sort of marriage, or at least an initial relationship. But back to this sort of little story, and I suspect many of you have heard this story, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. But here we have six researchers, and I think when I was told this story initially, they were six blind men. These are six blind researchers, each touching a various part of an elephant. And you can see that each one, depending on the part that they're touching, think that they're touching something differently. Now, the cool thing about this story is it can be used to illustrate lots of points. I'm going to use it today to compare induction and deduction. Obviously, from an inductive standpoint, if each person is touching the elephant, i.e. collecting data, they are coming up with a unique answer. And none of those answers are correct, and they're all different from one another. So I was sort of presented this story as this is what's bad about induction, that we don't have the truth, because everybody has a unique answer, and that's why a deductive approach makes sense. If we start with the theory of an elephant, perhaps everybody would say, oh yes, this is this part of the elephant. So I just want to keep that elephant in the room, pardon me for saying that, as we kind of go forward. I shouldn't have said that. But. So before we go any further, Jeff, I think, is going to kind of hit this a little harder. I just want to suggest that particularly as researchers, but just as humans in general, I think we do two things. We collect data, and then we try to make sense of that data. Now, the ordering of that could vary. The rinse and repeat part of it, right? We collect data, we develop theory, we collect more data, we reevaluate the theory, and so on and so on. I was always told that we start with number two and then collect the data, right? That's being a good deductive thinker, that deduction is inherently better. That's what I was told. I hope to suggest to you today that I don't believe that anymore. And so I'm going to ask you a question. You see here a string of numbers. Imagine that I'm collecting data. Those are the first four numbers in the series. Could ask you what number comes next. And let me preface the next several slides with this. I know in the summary of this talk, or this session, it said the material will be presented, I think the term was digestible. You'll see some math and you'll see some numbers here. You don't need to worry about that, okay? This is not a math, there will be no math, to quote Chevy Chase. Classic Saturday Night Live bit. There will be no math in this, but I do want you to sort of look at this and think about what number might come next here. I think if most of us sat down, I might need a calculator to do it, but you can see here we're multiplying by 3, right? So most people would say 243. And in fact, this is an item taken from a state test, right? An achievement test. The actual answer is it could be any number. Any number could complete that series because that series is just a function, right? It's a function in which we have a set of unknowns, right? And we are trying to depending on the weights associated with the values, we would generate different answers. So different weights could give us different answers. And again, this is not math, this is just to illustrate something. That first equation, if that's our reality, if that's really where those numbers were coming from, that's the real world, the actual next number in sequence would be 108. If we would plug 5 in for n, we would get 108, not 243. If instead our reality was this second function, the answer would be 130. It's similar to the elephant problem, right? We're each touching a different part. We don't know exactly what we're touching. We could actually generate an enormous number of answers. And again, you could look at that and say, that's what's bad about induction. But that's also interesting too, right? Because we aren't necessarily constrained in our thinking. I would say this is sort of an issue of extrapolation, right? We're trying to go beyond where the data are. We could have a similar problem even when we have data that are bounded. I had a colleague who for many years talked about why science is so boring, that we ask uninteresting questions, that we train mice to run mazes, and we know that they run a certain maze at a certain speed if the sugar solution is 5 milliliters. We know what they run at if it's 15. But nobody's ever run the study where we put 10 milliliters in to see. And he would say, see, if you do that study, who cares, right? Well, the answer is maybe it's not a linear function, right? So the problem could be even when we have bounded data, there isn't necessarily one answer because we don't actually know what that underlying model is. So inductive reasoning doesn't guarantee a correct solution because there are multiple solutions. So therefore, stay away from it. That's what I was always trained to think about. But I guess what I would suggest, and I talked with Fred about this earlier, he threw the frisbee. I was actually going to bring a baseball and throw it, but I thought I didn't want to hit somebody. But let me suggest to you that take a Major League Baseball player, an outfielder, played baseball his entire life. When he's standing in center field and the ball leaves the bat, I suspect, I'm just guessing this, I don't think that outfielder is taking into account all of the functions, right, all the physical properties associated with the ball. He's not calculating the angle that's leaving the bat. He's not sitting there doing those calculations. It's going on in here, right? We do that every day. We do that with anything we're doing. We're actually pretty good at that. So if it's good enough for us in our everyday life, right, when we cross a busy street, we don't figure out, well, how fast is that car going, and let me calculate how much time I have to get. No, we kind of make sense on the fly. So if it's good enough for everyday life, why can't it be good enough for our science? And what I would suggest is, even though a single solution, we don't know necessarily that it's correct, right, it could be an interesting place to start. And some of the examples Fred already gave, and I think some of the examples Jeff will give are good illustrations of that. But I would just want to pump the brakes a little bit on being too over the top and suggesting inductive reasoning is better either, in that we could easily find ourselves back in the days of Dust Bowl empiricism, where we're just letting data drive our decisions. And I think to Fred's earlier point about, we want to be cautious about that, obviously, but we also, I think, don't necessarily have to cut off our nose to spite our face. So, it's a backstory to big data, right? There have been a number of sessions this PSYOP. What I want to first suggest to you is that I think, as a field, we don't necessarily have a very good definition of what we think of as big data, right? In the sort of big data world, we define it as the 4 Vs, right? Volume, veracity, velocity, and variety. So big data, there's a lot of it. Right? Veracity speaking to how certain are we in the quality of those data, the accuracy of those data. Velocity, the data come at us very quickly. It updates very fast. And then variety, it comes through a lot of different channels. There's lots of different pieces of information. Now, I just want to say a little bit about the way, when I think of big data in a very general sense, some of the examples that come to my mind, and then I want to see if we can get that kind of into our world a little bit and see where there might be some points of linkage. So one of the first things that came to my mind was the super collider, right? The Hadron super collider. And I had to write this down because I knew I would get these, I would forget these numbers. I think this is pretty cool. So the Hadron super collider, there's 150 million sensors. The data are collected 40 million times per second in each of those sensors, and there are 600 million collisions per second. They analyze 0.001% of all the data they collect, and that is 25 petabytes of data per year. Now, I had no idea what a petabyte was, and you probably do. I'm still working on my Commodore 64. A petabyte is 1,000 terabytes. Seems like a lot. So big, right? That seems big to me. I sort of like astronomy stuff. The telescope that sort of looks out and maps the galaxy, been up since 2000, collects 200 gigabytes of data a night. So in the last roughly 15 years, 140 terabytes so far. There's a new telescope that will be put online in 2016. It'll collect that amount every 5 days. A lot of data. Walmart collects 1 million transactions an hour, 2.5 petabytes. That corresponds roughly to 167 times the amount of information in the Library of Congress. So I would say, yeah, that seems like big data to me. In I.O., maybe there are, I don't know of data sets that are that big. There might be some, and I would love to hear them. Some of the examples that I've heard people give are things like our big, large selection system. So some of the Project A data, for example, might be big data. I guess my point is, I think there's a sliding scale here, obviously, right? It's a bit relative. What's big to one person might not be big to another, but I think that would be one example. There are some performance tracking and management systems, right, where we're collecting data at the level of seconds, right? People's performance at the level of seconds. So that might be big data. You know, Krista mentioned the project that I'm working on, the NSF project, is focused on learning. And this is learning at the moment where we're focused on students. And they interface with an automated tutor, an online tutoring agent. And this is work that my collaborator really is responsible for developing. It's a program called MetaTutor. But the idea is, as they're acquiring this information, they are interacting with these agents. And we're looking at things like, what are the nature of those interactions? Do an individual's emotions influence whether they're bored, whether they're happy, whether they learn more, whether they tune out? So we're collecting data at the level of, actually, in milliseconds. We have physiological data, blood pressure, GSR, pulse rate, things of that type. We're collecting tracking, eye tracking data, again, very quick, very small increments of time. We have some self-report data, mood, how things are going at any given point. We have some knowledge-based data. In some of the scenarios, we have people doing think-aloud protocols. So we're collecting data across multiple channels. That's starting to feel a little bit big. At least it feels big to me when we have to start playing around with it. And I also think some of our social networking work might correspond to this idea of big data. And I just want to share with you, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Immersion project at MIT. I wanted to do this live, but I got nervous for two reasons. One is, whenever I do something live that requires technology, the technology always fails. So that was one. And the other is, it requires me to share my password and login information on this network, and I guess I was just a little paranoid about that. But if you go to this website, and you're willing to do this, it requires a bit of a leap of faith, this program will analyze all of your Gmail that you've ever sent or received, and it will create a network map. There's my network map. Now, we just moved at IIT to Gmail about a year and a half ago, so this map is based on about 100,000 emails. These nodes represent individuals. The bigger the node, the more communication I've had with that person, and then the nodes also connect individuals. So to me, lots of data, right? This is trying to make sense of those data. Now, I would be amazed if any of you could interpret that. You could put names on it, and again, I still wouldn't expect you to be able to interpret this. But the different colors that you see up here, Let me see if I can pull out a few of these. So the red part of that network, those are people on our campus, but outside of psychology that I have to interact with a lot. Right? So those are, you could call that my administrative part of the network. The green are our internal psych staff. So that's another sort of part of the network, and we see sort of those connections. The brown, I just mentioned this NSF grant, those are the team members associated with the NSF grant. The little three nodes sitting out there on their own are my family. I don't let them communicate with people at work. Actually, I tend not to use my IT account to communicate, so it does look a little bit funny. But the point would be, this is a massive amount of data. It looks pretty. And the reason I wanted to show it to you is that as it analyzes the emails, you can actually see this network sort of being formed, and it changes, and it's kind of fun to play around with. But again, if we don't know what we're looking for, how would we ever make sense of this? I can make sense of it because I know the people. It makes sense to me. So again, I think inductive thinking, starting with data and trying to interpret what's going on, could be pretty cool, but it requires knowledge. It requires, to Fred's point, some kind of thought. So, I think I'm not here to bury, by any means, deductive reasoning or research, but I do think it's important to emphasize both of these approaches have strengths and limitations, and it's silly to completely discount a way of understanding the world that actually got us pretty far, right? We're at this point in our history because of inductive thinking. We don't want to just throw it out. I think we need to be a little more open that there are potentially different ways of, a former colleague of mine always called it making science, which I always love. I think we need to appreciate that and recognize those strengths and weaknesses. And what I really want to suggest to you too is, as we think about this, these examples come up every day, right? I was watching MSNBC the other night, and they're talking about taking a look at how people respond to high-profile social events and trying to map those responses onto some underlying social processes. For example, they were showing how, and this is work from Mike Tesler at Brown University, he's responsible for a lot of this. But if you go back to the Bernard Goetz shooting back in the 70s in the subways, what they show is what were the percentages of individuals, in this case black and white, who sort of supported Goetz. And as you might imagine, the racial breakdown, right, was a little disproportionate. There were actually more blacks who were offended by Goetz than there were whites. But if you looked at the broken down by political party, Republican and Democrat, there were virtually no differences between those groups. Right? And there were, through many examples, working through present day examples, what they attempt to argue is that what happens is over time, for example, the Donald Sterling racial stuff, there was an example with 12 Years a Slave, that we see these racial differences on various social issues, which might not be unexpected, but that's what's happened over the last, 30 years or so, that the same trends are now tracking into Republican and Democrat, and arguing that essentially race and politics are becoming isomorphic. Is that true? The data sort of seem to suggest that, but there's got to be more thought than just going with the numbers, so to speak. There's also a website that I'll kind of plug, I have no interest in it. I came across, I thought it was kind of cool, on spurious correlations. It's tylervegan.com. Some of you have probably seen it. If you haven't, you can go there and find examples of lots of weird variables and look at the correlations between the two. One of my personal favorites is, I was sort of just playing around with it, correlation of 0.87. So let's be honest, that's a pretty big correlation. Correlation between the number of women on the Harvard Law Review Board in a given year and the number of movies that Nick Cage was in that year. Right? It's things like that. And again, is that correlation 0.86? I'm assuming it was calculated, right? So yeah, it was. But what does that mean? Well, it means if we want more women on the law review, we've got to get Nick Cage in more movies, right? Obviously. So those are the kinds of things that we have to think about. And I think when we see those things in our everyday life, I think it's silly that we don't bring them into our science, right? That we can work with that. We just need to come at it with a critical eye. So my last point there, I guess, I would just argue that we always have to think, right? That if we go towards an inductive way of reasoning for some issues, we can't just absolve ourselves and say, oh, the data say this, so therefore, obviously, that's the answer. With that, I'm going to stop.
Thanks very much, Ron. Our third and last speaker today is Jeff Edwards. Jeff is the Belk Distinguished Professor of Organizational Behavior at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His research addresses person-environment fit, stress and coping, and methodological topics that include different scores, polynomial regression, structural equation modeling, construct validity, and the development and evaluation of theory. Jeff is past editor of Organizational Behavior and Human Decision Processes and past chair of the Research Methods Division of the Academy of Management. Jeff's presentation today will offer a finer-grained explanation of the distinctions between inductive and deductive research, and will provide, by way of example, how we can combine both paradigms in a highly rigorous and defendable way.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Good afternoon. Good to see you. Thank you for spending time here with us this afternoon instead of being out in the sun. I'm very pleased to be part of this session. My dear friend and colleague Bob Vandenberg was originally scheduled to be in this session, and for family reasons had to leave earlier than initially scheduled. So if you were coming here to see Bob Vandenberg and you're wondering how he got 6 inches shorter, it's because I'm not Bob, I'm Jeff. So I'll do my best to live up to the charge of discussing with you some issues around inductive and deductive research. So let me jump right in. I want to frame up where I'm headed with this discussion in terms of the research cycle that many of us are familiar with, something that it's hard to dodge this when you're in graduate school and you take your first research methods class, of the research cycle that starts with theory, moves on to research questions and hypotheses, down around the cycle to research design, observation, and then back up through data analysis, interpretation of findings, and empirical generalizations. So I like to think of the deductive research as starting with theory and wrapping down around that way. Inductive research starting with observation and then moving up to developing theory and hypotheses. And so if we think about this cycle and our training and the kinds of patterns that we see in our field, I think the question for all of us is, where are you in this cycle? Where are each of us in this cycle? I would say that many of us are trained to be starting at the cycle at the top, that is the right, the preferred way, the more pure, sacred way of doing research. We start with theory. Who wouldn't want to be starting with the theory? And then we move around the cycle. There are others who would identify themselves more as inductive researchers, often those with more of a qualitative bent, so starting with observation and then moving up to theory. And I'm going to lobby for the idea that there's value in being ambidextrous, if you will, and living in both parts of the cycle. And I want to particularly focus on the inductive side from a quantitative standpoint. That's where I'll be heading with this. So what is the case for deductive research? What is the allure, and why are we drawn to it? One of it is just the drive to be theory-driven. Theory-driven has a nice panache to it. We want to have our research being driven by theory, because otherwise it's just going to meander. There's no theory behind it. The crutch of theoretical justification, now crutch may be a bit of a harsh term, but what I'm referring to here is when we see decisions being made in research where, say, a measure is chosen or a design is used or a sample is drawn, and the explanation is that, well, we have a theoretical justification for doing that. It was driven by theory. And it's almost like a get-out-of-jail-free card. Once you say it's driven by theory, then it's all hands off, and on you proceed. A third draw of deductive research is the abhorrence of the a-theoretical. I'm reminded of an article by, a classic article by Mook in defense of external invalidity. And to paraphrase from that article, if you're not being theoretical, then you're being a-theoretical. And one might as well wish for acne if you're going to be a-theoretical. So who would want to be such a thing? And finally, the obsession with theory, that maybe theory has gotten to the point where it's viewed as an end in its own right, that it's not really so much serving a purpose of driving empirical research, but it has become an obsession, almost an addiction. Don Hambrick wrote a provocative article in 2007 where he says, the requirement of an articulation of theory and everything we write actually retards our ability to achieve our end, which is understanding. So what's the complementary arguments then for inductive research? It puts our research in context. It helps us connect ourselves back to the in work environments that we are attempting to understand with the work that we do, loosening the constraints of our paradigms. Paradigms are enabling. They're empowering. They give us structure for how we observe, the questions we ask, and the tools in our hands. But they also, by virtue of providing that guidance, they do put us in lanes that we swim in, and those lanes can be constraining. We're better connected to the phenomena we study if we go and visit them, actually in the field. Dare to set aside our surveys and our MTurk samples and go out into the field and get close and comfortable with the people we're studying in their own context to reconnect, either as an initial part of our research or periodically to refresh. And finally, the spirit of discovery. And this was alluded to earlier, that most research, even the deductive research that we point to, has its origins or genesis in something that was inductive. I would venture to guess that most of us started our research careers because we experienced interesting, puzzling, important, compelling phenomena in our own working lives, and that became part of our entry into what we wanted to study. But we can look at some classic examples of work that became deductive but has its origins in what was it fundamentally inductive. You're probably all familiar with the parable, the tale of Frederick Taylor and Schmidt the pig iron handler, where these were observations, qualitative, if you will, investigations of looking at how time and motion, essentially, studies of the efficiency with which people were doing physical labor, this in the Bethlehem steel plant, for this example, and how this was then formalized into what became scientific management. So this is, takes us back a century. Something a little bit more contemporary, Turner and Lawrence, taking a look at some of the ways that intrinsically jobs can affect behavior. And here he quotes as saying, the evidence suggests that in general, good attendance records were driven primarily by, I'll say what's at the end, greater interest and involvement in the work itself, not from incentives. And this was then the genesis of job characteristics research and what has followed since then. In the stress area, Robert Kahn and colleagues in their classic book on the role conflict and ambiguity, the work that they did to try to understand what stress was about was by asking people to describe a typical bad day, and from there formalizing what became one of the most dominant models of stress, with role ambiguity and role conflict and role overload as the driving concepts. So qualitative and quantitative research can be both deductive and inductive. So I want to decouple the typical association of quantitative being always deductive and qualitative being inductive. And I'll put it in context like this. If we cross qualitative and quantitative across the top with deductive and inductive, is there really activity in all four of those cells? I would say there is. We just don't often visit some of those cells. We spend time in the lower left quadrant, if you will, ethnography being an example of an inductive qualitative approach. And then confirmatory analysis, many of the quantitative tools that we use have a confirmatory flair to them. We specify a model, we test the model, we seek to confirm the model. But the upper left-hand cell could be case study research. Robert Yin has done writing on case study methodology, where the methodology includes techniques such as pattern matching and explanation building, where those questions being asked are a priori questions and seek to answer questions those questions with a deductive approach applied to qualitative data. And I'll put exploratory analysis down in the bottom right-hand corner here. I mean, rigorous exploratory analysis and I'll give you some examples of the types of analyses I'm talking about here. Now, before you run for the doors, you know, exploratory quantitative analysis, it often gets a bad rap. It has some negative terms associated with it, so let me absolve us of falling under the spell of exploratory quantitative research that's not of the type I would promote. What inductive quantitative research is not, it's not Dust Bowl empiricism here, where we have the data itself as the end of the story, so the patterns that we see, we take those as truth, devoid of an explanation and devoid of what could inform theory. It's not what data grubbing. Data grubbing, where we get involved in the data itself and look to see what we might see, grub around for patterns. Not a nice word. It's not a nice image. So none of us want to be data grubbers. It's also not capitalizing on chance, where we just roll the dice and see what comes out of a particular study that we might do with a particular data set and take that as truth. All data, all findings that we have are they're results of at least two things. A model in the population that we're trying to discover, and the randomness in the sample that we happen to draw. And those are confounded whenever we do any analysis. So I'm not suggesting that we're going to be looking at or advocating research where anything we might discover in any particular sample is in fact truth. Nor am I referring to hypothesizing after results known. This is a shot of Paul Newman playing Henry Gondorf in The Sting, where he stacked the deck before he came and played poker with his nemesis in the film. Stacking the deck, meaning that we already know what the results are, and then afterwards we try to knit together a story, call it a theory, call it hypotheses, when we already know it's a foregone conclusion what the results would be. All of these approaches have a bad rap, and they deserve it. And these are not the approaches that I'm advocating for us here today. I'm talking about the use of techniques that you may already be familiar with, but with a different mindset, and maybe supplementing some of what we're familiar with. I want to suggest to you that many of the methods that we use are not inherently exploratory or confirmatory, but they can be placed on a continuum depending on how we as researchers apply them and the choices that we make. A regression analysis could pretty much span the spectrum from confirmatory, if we have specific variables that we're going to test and that is it, all the way over to exploratory. Again, not advocating, but just mentioning we could use stepwise regression, for instance, and that would be more of an exploratory approach. The tool is there. Exploratory factor analysis, I've shifted a little bit more toward the exploratory end of things, but if you look at the history of factor analysis, particularly predating confirmatory factor analysis, many of the EFAs were done with a spirit of confirmation, that there was a number of factors that the researcher was hoping to discover. So it's more of an attitude or application of the tool. Confirmatory factor analysis will be shifted inherently more to the right, but there we can also modify models based on the findings that we see. There are different structures we can test to compare to one another, and so that we can have an exploratory application toward the exploratory end of the continuum for CFA as well, and structural equation modeling the same. We can modify structures, the causal structures embedded in a model. That's on top of modifying what the measurement model would look like. So my point is that these methods of analysis are not inherently exploratory or confirmatory, that what makes research exploratory or confirmatory goes back to a quote from John Tukey, who's often credited with coining the term exploratory data analysis in a formal way. He says it's really more an attitude or state of flexibility. It's about a willingness to see what we didn't expect. So it's exploratory data analysis. It's not methods don't make for exploratory research. Researchers make for exploratory research. It's the attitude and the approach that we take with whatever tool might be in our hands. Going beyond some of the traditional tools and applying them in an exploratory fashion, we can look at other techniques such as data mining, histograms, and seeing shapes of distributions that you might not otherwise see. Looking at scatter plots, stem and leaf plots, box and whisker plots, bivariate density distributions in three dimensions, and contour diagrams all the way down to smoothing techniques to look for patterns in data as they're strung out over time, for instance. All of these are techniques that you probably have heard of. They're advocated by Tukey and others who write about exploratory data analysis from a formal, rigorous standpoint. So let me give you an illustration of some graphical techniques of how we might be able to see what we didn't expect to see. I'm offering up for you just a simple correlation matrix of some variables from a study that I did with Dan Cable of the value of value congruence was the name of the article. But I just conjured up four variables and showing you correlations, and we often find ourselves looking at results like these. We assume that these relationships implicitly are linear. That's what a correlation effectively assumes. There's no information here about the distribution of the variables. I could have put in means and standard deviations into this table, and if I had, we'd effectively be assuming that the variables are normally distributed, that all it takes is the first two moments, mean and variance, to describe the distributions. But let's take more of a graphical look at what these results might actually mean and what these variables might mean. Here is a set of graphs. Along the diagonal is the distribution of each variable. And in the off diagonal, those lines, those correspond to the correlations that you just saw. Now here, at this stage, we're assuming linearity, as we do when we compute a correlation. We're also assuming normality of the variables because we haven't dared to look to see yet whether or not that assumption would be supported. But why don't we go ahead and put in bivariate distributions, the ellipses that give us a sense of where the data tend to be clustered. As you can see, for some of these, the data are clustered up toward the right. You can't tell that just from the straight line where the data is. So we're getting a little bit closer by overlaying the ellipse. We can replace the distributions with histograms, and now we can see the actual shapes of the distributions. You can see this is intent to stay. This variable down here is skewed over. It's skewed to the left, meaning that the bulk of the data is to the right. So people planning to more people are indicating they would intend to stay with their jobs. The data are clustered up to the right. Similar for job satisfaction. We could add scatter plots to get even closer look of where the data are where the data lie. Again, we see that there's some skewness. This distribution, the correlation between intent to stay and job satisfaction, clustered up to the right. Now we're getting a closer feel as to where the data lie. Why don't we replace those ellipses with kernel density contours that now relax an inherent assumption that an ellipse is all you need to describe the bivariate distribution? That's essentially, it's a bivariate normality distribution assumption that we've relaxed here with the density plots. How about if we relax the assumption of linearity and just let's just shoot a quadratic through these and see what these relationships look like now? Well, this variable is communication, and there is job satisfaction, two panels up, and the line curves down. So what that suggests is that as we communicate more freely in organizations, that our satisfaction with our jobs go up, but they're diminishing returns. It's going from little communication to at least some moderate levels, having more bang for the buck in terms of satisfaction than once you get beyond that. Well, we're only using a squared term here to capture nonlinearity. We can also go to locally weighted smoothing techniques that essentially will take each point along the line, along the x-axis, looking at the points that are a little bit above and a little bit below, and then connecting a line and then piecing it together. For that point now, we can see what the data are trying to, as if they have volition, what they're trying to say to us at a very localized level. Now, in terms of what you might find if you test this, the nonlinear relationships that you saw, say, between communication and job satisfaction, the curvilinearity happened to register as significant, in case you're a fan of that, in this particular data. So it wasn't just an artifact of what we can observe. But the point of these techniques is to open our eyes to seeing what might be behind our data. Something as simple as a set of correlations that you saw, that's a closer look at what, in fact, was under the hood in terms of those correlations. So we have exploratory techniques. We have visualizations, some informal techniques that may seem to be, well, in the hands of those who are not being careful, that it can be open to lots of mischief. So how do we bring rigor and respectability to these kinds of methods? One is to be sensitive to the outliers and influential cases that could drive the results. Those curves that you saw, there might be an aberrant case that could have a line shoot up to grab that one case. Be sensitive to the proportion of cases in our data that are giving rise to a pattern. If only 1% are causing what seems to be an interesting discovery, well, maybe that 1% is not, we want to base our interpretation more on the 99% of the data. And of course, there's literature on how we identify outliers and influential cases. Using non-parametric techniques that relax distributional assumptions, the bootstrap being a case in point, where we can apply inferential tests, statistics, without assuming a particular distribution of a parameter. Cross-validate what we find. If we have samples that are big enough, then there's some value in splitting the sample into two random stratified samples, exploring in both halves, and then cross-validating on the other half. This is called double cross-validation, and John Campbell wrote about this in the 1976 Dunnett Handbook. And finally, replicate. You know, replicate is there's controversy in our field as the replication is rare. The value is often questioned because we always want to bring something novel to the research that we do. But there are journals that are coming to the fore, such as the Academy of Management Discoveries, that are putting value on replication. It certainly is something that we're schooled to think about back to the research cycle, and there certainly is value for replication if we're going to be using our methodology in the spirit of discovery. Thank you.
So I think we've heard three really invigorating discussions here and examples of how we can combine these schools of thought that really aren't so distinct and really advance the science of I.O. So what I want to do now is open the floor up for questions. So I'll ask our three speakers to come up front. I don't know if you want to pull these chairs forward.
Actually, just lower the screen for it, it won't be behind.
Thank you.
Any questions?
I think it's an interesting artifact of the tendencies to equate qualitative with exploratory and quantitative with confirmatory research, and that if we agree that there's value in induction, then that I would argue that should be independent of the method that we happen to use to conduct the inductive research. Some of the award-winning papers in journals such as the Academy of Management Journal have been inductive qualitative. Studies, so there certainly are. There's respectable and important work being done with that method. I'm encouraging us to be a bit more open-minded about quantitative approaches to inductive exploratory research, but with the important caveats of cross-validation and replication and so forth. So it isn't just a field day, and anything we see in the numbers is we assume to be a window to truth.
Well, I think the inductive process to construct validation work, I suppose, lies on a continuum, similar to Jeff's continuum with the analyses being more inductive or deductive in nature. So say you're developing a measure of a new construct, you could do it by contacting SMEs, starting de novo, using people within the local setting in case there's a local flavor that needs to be magnified with respect to what you're looking at. And you're right that takes a lot of work. And you're also right to say that we often don't want to go to that sort of work. And we justify not going to that sort of work by saying perhaps the local setting is a nuance and that we really can get the strength of generalization will carry us through. Whether that's true or not is, in many cases, an empirical question that we just don't take the time to answer. But we do see reasonable amounts of reliability and validity and so on across settings that we're comfortable, maybe too comfortable, to go into the local setting. But that's where, you know, qualitative strengths can be developed within psychology, and we can dive further into the qualitative and mixed methods to have that enhance or supplement construct validation, measure development, and so on.
Let me say something that I haven't really thought through, so this could be bad, but as you were asking that question, it occurs to me that when I learned how to do job analysis, that's exactly what I was taught to do, that you go in and you ask people questions to try to understand what the job is. So why is it, I'm sort of reflecting back on your question, why is it that we're comfortable doing that, but to your point, we seem less interested in doing it maybe when we're developing measures for ourselves. Maybe it's because our job analyses could end up in court and we might be sued and we might, I don't know, I'm just speculating that, but I guess I would say I wouldn't, we do have a mechanism for doing it. We do have a mechanism for understanding a construct space from sort of the bottom up. So, I don't have a great answer for why we're not. I think, to paraphrase Fred, maybe we're a little lazy. Did I paraphrase you right? Maybe a little bit, but
a little.
No other questions? Okay, well, I'll just make a final closing point. I want to really echo something that Fred brought up. I think being able to do the things that they've all talked about today stems from getting it into our graduate training, right? That's a really important part of this. And into our journal reviewing process, right? Into the editorial boards being more open to thinking about both these types of research and the validity of both of them. So, or just as a field, right, to move forward and take action on that. I want to, again, thank our three speakers for a fabulous session, and thank Lo for co-coordinating with me. And on behalf of the entire theme track, thank everyone for attending, and enjoy the rest of your PSYOP.